Welcome to another episode of the Leisure Wheels podcast. Today we're here in Pretoria with Johan Badenhorst, and he's agreed to chat with us about his fairly recent trip. Thank you so much for joining us, Johan.
Thanks, Heath.
If we can start off, what prompted the decision to travel along the equator with your most recent trip?
Recently we've done, with Voetspore, we've done mostly transcontinental journeys, traveling from the one side of the continent to the other. And most of them were actually north-south or south-north, Casablanca to the Cape, Alexandria, or Agulhas to Alexandria and so on. And what was quite good about these trips is that if you travel transcontinentally, you go through all the climate zones of the continent. So you start off, say, in the Sahara, in the desert, go through the rainforest and then back into southern Africa and all the other way around. But this time we decided, let's do a different trip. Let's go east-west along the equator, which means that we would have similar climatic conditions, although this is one of the most difficult trips to do on the continent. As a matter of fact, very few people do a trip like this.
This is actually one of the questions, because it's obviously quite a bit shorter than the lengthwise, but I suppose it wasn't any easier.
It was our shortest trip, but also our longest trip. Shortest in the sense of the number of kilometers actually covered. We did about 10,000 kilometers, of which 2,000 was spent on the river. So on the odometer of a vehicle was only about 8,000 kilometers. Compare that to the Casablanca trip, which was 23,000 kilometers. Sure. So it's about a third. About 10,000 kilometers, much shorter, but on the other hand, time-wise, much longer.
And the roads, I suppose, was the main reason for...
Not too many roads. I mean, the real problematic part was this one section in the Congo, and was a mere 700 kilometers. But then, and that 700 kilometers took us a week to do.
Sure.
But the main issue then is getting onto the river and getting off the river. And that can actually take forever. That took us the better part of 2 months. Yes.
When exactly did this trip take place?
We started off on the 1st of June. On the Indian Ocean, a small, beautiful town on an island called Lamu. And Lamu is up on the Kenyan coast. And we ended the trip, finalized it, when we reached Mwanda on the Atlantic Ocean on the 10th of September. So the 3 months and a bit. And so, and then we drove back home, and we were back in South Africa by the 18th of September.
And the countries you went through?
Only 3 countries. That's the other amazing part of it. So normally we do 8, 9, 10, up to 12 countries.
Exactly, yes.
This time it was Kenya, Uganda, DRC. Okay, and as we drove back, it was also through Angola and Namibia and so on. But 3 countries. Only 2 places where we actually needed visas. You know, for Kenya you don't need a visa.
Yes.
So we had visas for Uganda and for the DRC. And that was it.
And what were the roads like?
The roads in Kenya and Uganda is good, excellent. Some of them bottled and so on, you know. But actually, the quality of the of where we travelled in Kenya and Uganda is very much like South Africa.
A lot of tar roads and that sort of thing.
A lot of tar roads and so quite often through not freeways, but often through villages where you have the speed humps that slow you down and so on. Many of the roads are newly built. But then the main problem is the other traffic on the roads, especially heavy vehicles, you know.
Yes.
The road between Mombasa and Nairobi is a terrible one because of the traffic, not because of the road conditions. And so, but then suddenly you hit the DRC, and then it just becomes something totally different, you know.
I mean, you guys had quite a struggle just getting into the DRC, didn't you?
We had a problem getting into the DRC. We went up to Arua, and just getting through that border crossing it took us a day, and it was raining, and we went to the wrong border post and so on. And there was suddenly the language barrier becomes an issue, because these guys speak French. That's it. And so, and so eventually we got in, and then, but the other problem is that a lot of people are viewed in a very difficult light in that part of the world because of the rebel activities. You have Lord's Resistance Army, you have the M23 rebels, you have other guys like the Morgan rebels and so on. And suddenly, as six guys in three well-kitted Amaroks arriving, you know. Mm. Who are they? What are they doing here? And so they searched us quite thoroughly when we entered at Arua. And so not be bothered by a bottle of whiskey or anything like that. And so
the safety thing more.
Looking for something else. You know, looking if we are not actually smuggling weapons in or something like that.
You know? So do you feel that tension? Do you sense this is an area with quite a lot of violence?
So everything just changes. The moment when you get from Kenya, Uganda into the DRC, everything changes. Suddenly there's every second guy carries a gun, AK-47, you know. And so everything is people are extremely friendly. I must honestly say that the normal man in the street and some of the guys that we encountered along the way were brilliant, fantastic people. But there's just such a massive presence of people in uniform carrying guns.
Yes.
You know, and then you get a roadblock and you have to pay taxes or toll fees and so on, plus a little extra. There's always, the Congo, you always have to pay what they refer to as small money. You know, always the policeman doing his job expects of you to pay him some small money.
And what kind of fee would that be?
If you speak in dollars, they always want the $100 and so on.
That's a starting point.
Yeah. I quickly changed that into a Congolese franc, and then the fee that I was happy or comfortable with and so on was 2,000 Congolese franc, which is about 20 rand.
Okay.
So, said, whenever I get to a border post and there's seven guys sitting there, I give them, you know, 2,000 times seven, 14,000 yeah. Congolese franc, you know. And if they want to argue about me, I'll just turn. And then you've given them something, and then it's sorted. Then it's not a problem.
Is it quite intimidating traveling through the DRC, or were you at no stage really, do you feel threatened at all? Or
we never felt threatened, and so but there's a way of managing that. You travel from town to town.
Hmm.
When you get to the town, you just don't continue before actually making 100% sure what the security situation is. If they tell you that it's fine, that there was no knowledge of recent activities of rebels, then you continue on this road. If they tell you that the rebels are active, then you stay put. We were fortunate at that stage so that we managed to continue. I mean, we arrived at a town at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but then you won't continue because you cannot make the next town until.
Okay.
So then you stay there until the next morning, then you leave. I've realized this on many travels before as well, and so on. It's a good thing to travel early in the morning. Rebels. Or whether it's the ninjas in Congo Brazzaville or wherever and so on, they don't operate before 12 o'clock. In the,
I suppose they drink late, so they get up late.
That's exactly what happens. Yeah. So you before sunrise, you leave town and you try and get to the next destination by 12 o'clock, you know, and then you're, we were okay on this trip.
And then the roads in the DRC, you mentioned when we were speaking earlier that's quite bad.
The interesting thing about this, Gert, is that this is a transcontinental highway. This is the road that links Mombasa to Lagos. And furthermore, it's a main road. It's the M1 in the Congo.
Yes, yes.
But the moment when you leave Bunia and you continue to Mombasa and from there to Ipulu and from there to Bafosende and so on, it is the last stretch of that road, of this about 700 kilometers, the last about 90 kilometers, is a good gravel road with not too many obstacles and so on. But that first, say, 500-600 kilometers, it is probably the worst, it's the worst national road that I've ever been to, ever been on, you know. Because the moment when a truck or a vehicle or so gets stuck, the other guys can't get past. The forest, the rainforest of Africa is just too thick.
Yes.
It's impossible to pass. So you are lined up. At one point we got to where vehicles got stuck, and there was a queue of around about 300 trucks waiting for that one truck to be relieved. And they would also, once they get into that mud hole, it takes an hour or two or five or a day so to get it relieved from that by either with chains or with ropes or whatever, pulling it to the one side or the other, or people actually just getting rid of the slurry, the mud and so on, and then get branches or cut down trees with big chainsaws and actually putting them into the mud holes so the vehicles can pass over that area.
we were in Uganda once as well, and it was a similar thing. And there was a bus, and it actually stopped, and they opened up the compartment underneath, and it was packed full of rocks. And they started, all the people got off the bus, and they started packing these rocks, and it actually helped a bit.
Absolutely. These guys are fairly well organized to a certain extent. When an issue like this develops, and so on, one guy takes charge, he gets some other people who actually are just passengers on these vehicles and so on, and they start digging and whatever and so on. And then when we arrive, we pay a toll fee. And that toll fee is then gathered by one other individual who then distributes it amongst the people who helped to get these vehicles unstuck. So in a very informal way, these guys manage to, you know, somehow they make it work.
What happened when you had to deal with this road? You said it's about 600 kilometers of just trucks backed up. How long did it take you, and how did you eventually get through that?
It took us about 7 days, of which we spent a couple of days at Ipulu waiting for two of our guys to recover, who were suddenly struck down by malaria. In the middle of all of this and so on, both Gideon and Andre got malaria. So we couldn't continue. I mean, these guys had a fever of up to 40 degrees and so on. It was impossible to continue with them being ill at that stage and so on. So we gave them some time to recover. So all in all, it took us 7 days, but we were fortunate. We picked up a policeman. We gave a policeman a lift. So that, combined with the fact that we were prepared to pay a little bit more in this so-called toll fee, allowed us to, when we got to, for instance, 300 trucks, we passed them all and went right to the front, and there were about three or four other vehicles in front of us. So by the time they got through and so on, we were allowed to continue. So we didn't have to wait for all 300 to go. Otherwise, we still would have been there. You know?
I suppose the malaria that's the risk of traveling the equator. You're in a malaria area the entire time.
Yeah, that is the big problem. So, and we were aware of it beforehand. And we were fortunate to a certain extent that only two of the six guys got malaria, and that the malaria that they got was not the cerebral malaria, because if they had cerebral malaria, I don't know what would have happened. And so, because cerebral malaria, you die within a day or two. You know?
Exactly, and you're not going to get evacuated from it.
You're not going to get evacuated. I mean, I tried even my satellite phone there, where Gideon was struck down with him. The satellite phone wouldn't work, and so, because just
the canopy was just...
It is impossible. I mean, you would pick up a signal every now and again. So... yeah, malaria is, well, we gave them Coartem. Coartem is a brilliant medicine. It makes you as sick as can be for 3 days, but then unfortunately you recover after that, yeah.
Is that kind of how you managed it? Did you take any other pills or anything?
Beforehand, yes, you take malaria prophylaxis and so on to see to it that if you get the disease and so on, that it's not that bad. And then other precautions, like trying to wear long trousers and dark clothing and so on, and using a lot of tabard and stuff like that and so on. But somehow it's, and sleeping under mosquito nets. So that's the way you sleep. You sleep under mosquito net every night.
Yes.
That's the only way. But there are no 100% foolproof prevention of not getting malaria.
Can you tell us a bit about the river?
Yeah, the river is something. The river is an amazing part of the journey.
Because you traveled on the river, actually, for quite a while.
We arrived at Kisangani. We thought that we'll get onto the river within 2 days. Actually, our vehicles were loaded within 2 days onto a barge, thinking that we may depart every next day.
Yes.
16 days later, we realized that it's not going to happen. So then I moved my vehicles to another barge, which was going to depart soon. We then departed after 18 days from Kisangani, went down 3 days downriver, stopped at Bumba, and then stayed over for another 12 days at Bumba, doing nothing. And then eventually, when we departed from Bumba, we went all the way down to Kinshasa. We spent in total 28 days on the river, on the barge, with our three vehicles.
And this isn't what we picture when you think of a barge. This is really just a floating, informal settlement. You mentioned what they were eating and how people were living and that sort of thing.
That is absolutely true. This is just a floating big container which is pushed by a ship. Now, but then on the other hand, we were fortunate that we traveled first class.
so to speak.
We were on the back of the boat, the tugboat, which itself, was pushing this barge. So we had something of a compartment on which we could live and actually sleep and so on. So we were fairly comfortable on this barge. But yeah, but 28 days remains 28 days on the river. Yeah.
And how many people were on that barge by the end of it?
There were about between 50 and 60 vehicles, and there were between 350 and 400 people on the barge.
You mentioned when we were speaking earlier, canoes would just come up and they'd buy monkeys for dinner and that sort of thing.
This barge would go down the river at the speed of roughly about 13 kilometers an hour. And then people from the villages along this river and so on would actually join up with the barge in these dugout canoes, pirogues, they call them. And these pirogues would come and trade with the people on the barge, come and sell some stuff, like fish. We bought a lot of fish from them, for instance. Charcoal, cassava, maize, furniture, parrots, but then other stuff to eat, like, for instance, smoked fish, live crocodile, dead monkeys, smoked bats. A variety of stuff, and so there you go. Worms, there's lots of worms, like something like a Mupani worm.
Did you guys try any of these delicacies? Or
not of the monkeys and so on. That's they also, I mean, some of the people invited us for lunch or for dinner and so on, and they were preparing some of the stuff for us on the barge, but they would refer to the food that we would get there as Mzungu food. Now, Mzungu is the Swahili name for a white man. and they know what food we ate. Some of the fish, most definitely, but not of the monkeys and the crocodile I wouldn't mind and so on, but and not the monkeys or the bats or the snakes and so on. And for them it's delicatessens, you know, they actually feed on that. That's what they eat.
But I suppose when you're in that situation, that's not the right time to be adventurous with menu.
No, not at all. And so we take great care of our personal health. Like, for instance, we take a water purification system with, and we purify, because we ran out of water. We had clean water with us. After a week, we ran out of clean water. So
so much longer than you'd anticipated.
Normally, a trip from Kisangani to Kinshasa, which is 1,734 kilometers. The normal time for a trip like this is 2 weeks. You can't do it in any shorter time.
That's more or less.
Upstream 3 weeks, downstream 2 weeks, and so on. We took, for us it took a month, 4 weeks. So we ran out of food. We ran out of water. We ran out of everything. By the time we reached Kinshasa, we had half a cup of rice and two tins of baked beans left. And that was all we had, you know. So, it was a little bit different than any other Footspore journeys.
And once you got off the barge, was that kind of the worst of it over? Or
yeah. We then offloaded the vehicles in Kinshasa. We had fantastic cooperation from the people on the barge. Kinshasa will always remain Kinshasa, one of the most difficult cities in Africa to travel through.
It's got such a reputation for that as well.
Although I must say, I was amazed to see what the main roads in Kinshasa look like. The change that happened in 5-6 years in the city is absolutely amazing, except for at the harbour. That's all these barges lining up and so on. So we had to get our vehicles over about four barges, driving over about four barges, getting off onto something like just a couple of planks, which was laid on from the last barge onto the shore as such. And so, and the amazing thing is that we were able to film this. In the past and so on, whenever you took out a camera in Kinshasa, people start screaming at you.
Oh,
and
really? So
this time we filmed it from A to Z. It cost me a couple of $100 to do that.
But worth it.
Much less than what I anticipated.
And anything else that stands out apart from the DRC? Any other particularly memorable? You mentioned Obama's father's grave, for instance.
The interesting thing is that we came from Kenya to Uganda and then to the DRC. And now Kenya and Uganda feels like Africa for beginners. It feels like very, very simple. Your tarred roads and cell phone signal and ATMs that work and restaurants, if you so wish, and markets where you can go, ShopRite, Checkers, where you can go and buy your food and so.
Absolutely.
But there were some brilliant things that happened to us in Kenya and Uganda as well. In Kenya, for instance, we visited the grave of President Obama's father. We visited his grandmother, Mrs. Sarah Obama. She's 93 years old.
And what is she like?
She's wonderful, although she can't speak any English. She it's difficult for to communicate. We had to communicate through a interpreter and so on. But the grave of President Obama's father is there at her house. Barack Hussein Obama. His father and his grandmother are Muslim. He himself is not, but yes, they are Muslims. And so he only saw his father. His father and mother got divorced. He was born on, if I'm not mistaken, in Hawaii. Lived most of his time, I think, in the Philippines or Indonesia or so.
Right.
Got back to America. His father and mother got divorced. He only saw his father once. His father came back to Africa. And he only saw his father once more before he was killed in a car accident. So he'd been to his grandmother. There's a nice photograph of the young Obama, still, I think, about something like 18 or 19 years old, visiting his grandma near Kisumu. And interesting for us now doing this trip on the equator is that she lives on the equator. Her little house where she lives is on the equator.
And has it become a bit of a tourist attraction now because of, of this affiliation?
To a certain extent, yes. She says the moment when he became president, all the orphans of the entire region flocked to her house because she immediately they took it that she now must have money.
Money, absolutely.
Which she didn't have. Now she's getting a lot of donations from all over the world, mostly from Europe, not from America, strangely enough. Obama hadn't been back there to visit her, and so on. He promised that he will go before the end of his term. She's got some protection. There's one or two policemen living there, and so on. It was quite a problem for us getting in there.
I can imagine.
People want to know, who are you? Why? You made no appointment.
You show up with a convoy like that, people.
Rocking up, you know. And then we also had to make some donation to her orphanage, you know. That was obviously. So that was a very interesting thing. We had some good times on Lake Victoria. We went fishing on Lake Victoria. And then we went hiking in the Ruwenzori's, which is... we've done Kili and we've then done Kilimanjaro and so on. Ruwenzori's is just a little...
The mountains of the moon.
The mountains of the moon. The most spectacular mountain range on the African continent.
It really is unbelievable because it's not like Kilimanjaro, which is just a freestanding mountain. This is just an awe-inspiring range.
It's, I think, about 120 kilometers by 40 kilometers, the whole range. Where the highest peak is Mount Stanley with Margarita, which is... 5,100 meters, so it's pretty high. We didn't have the time, or perhaps the fitness, to do. The last bit is a glacier.
It's proper ice climbing that
absolutely.
You have to do.
Yeah,
I've heard
ice picks and crampons and stuff like that. We went to another peak called Wiseman, which was 4,600, I think, and 50 meters and so on. Pretty high as well.
That's high.
Very, very tiring, very, very difficult. The demands of this mountain range is amazing. But the scenery, the beauty of it and so on is just absolutely incredible. Currently, they have 500 visitors per year.
Unbelievable.
Sometimes you have 500 people on Kili on a day. You know.
Exactly.
So more and more people should actually go and visit the Ruwenzori's, I think.
Would you say Uganda is a practical holiday destination?
Absolutely. Daily flights to Entebbe. Daily flights, I mean. And then the Whitewater River rafting on the Nile, Jinja, is spectacular. Better than anywhere else on the African continent. You know, if you go to Vic Falls and so on, that's a good introduction to what you find on the Nile at Jinja. There are fantastic lodges like Wild Waters is on the Nile. It's on an island in the Nile. It's a 5-star lodge. Great you know, stuff and so on. Then obviously you can go to Burundi to go and visit the gorillas. Even better, than Rwanda. You can go to Queen Elizabeth National Park for some fantastic game viewing. To also some good lodges like Mweya, which is a brilliant place. You know. You can go up to the Ruwenzori's. You can go to Murchison Falls National Park with some good lodges, with some fantastic game viewings for some good fishing opportunities. Nile perch and Goliath tigers and stuff like that. And so no, Uganda is becoming a fantastic holiday destination, both for the adventurous as well as just the leisure travel people. I think that that's a place. And there are many, many people actually developing it to a large extent. And so I think that we'll find more and more people, South Africans, either driving up there, in their 4x4s and so on, or just flying up and enjoying the time.
And it is surprisingly developed. When we were there, for instance, we never lost cell phone signal, not even inside Queen Elizabeth Park. You can draw money wherever, Fuel's never a problem.
Never, not at all. I actually spoke to some of the guys working for the cell phone companies, MTN or so, working in Uganda. They have most of the time better cell phone connections than South Africa. Fiber throughout the country, you know.
I was amazed. I couldn't believe it.
G4.
Everyone had a cell phone.
Oh, yeah. Two or three or four.
You tiny know. Little mud hut, but people standing outside talking on their cell phones.
Texting, quite often. You get very small denominations, 5 rand airtime that you can load. But, and then also, if you can, you buy some airtime and convert it to data and so on. Brilliant. Absolutely fantastic.
And they apparently also have this system now where you can actually, it's a form of currency where you transfer.
Yeah. That is actually something which started and is seriously developed in Kenya.
I've heard that, yeah.
But now throughout most of other, even in South Africa, it's available. People just don't use it. It's called M-Pesa. Pesa is the Swahili word for money. And M-Pesa, mobile money, yes, mobile Pesa. And people trade in that all the time. You know, if I need to buy a bread from you, and so I ask you for your cell phone number, and I transfer the amount of my mobile money to yours. And so you can buy a Mercedes-Benz with your mobile money.
Literally virtual money that just apart from gets that, moved around.
You can send money to you. If you live in Nairobi and you need to send money to your mother who lives in North Hoor in the Chalbi Desert and so on, you transfer the money into her account. You don't have to travel there. Or,
as simple
or
as that.
It is, and it works like a charm. And whenever you want to cash it in, you go to the M-Pesa office and you cash it in. So the fantastic, it's like a wallet. The difference is that this wallet, you have a password on it. And you nobody can steal. If they steal your phone, they cannot have access to your money because they don't have your password.
Okay.
If they steal your wallet, they've got your money. You know.
Exactly.
So this, you don't have any interest on it, and somebody, you don't have any interest getting interest on your money in your wallet either. Mm. You know, so no, it works very well. In most African countries, this is becoming the norm. You know, and I don't know why we in South Africa are so slow to catch up on something like this.
You mentioned Murchison Falls. I've heard from quite a few people that that is also one of the undiscovered gems, that it's really one of the most spectacular parks that people just never visit.
The incredible thing about just speaking about Murchison Falls for a start, why is it, it's, if I tell you it's a waterfall which is, what's it, about 8 meters high, no, 43 meters high and 6 meters wide. Mm. Then you'd say 43 meters waterfall, there are many of them. The fact of the matter is that the Nile gets forced
into
through this 6 meter, the strongest natural force of water anywhere in the world. The 50 meters Nile River gets forced through 6 meters, drops 43 meters. But then the wildlife around Murchison, around the Nile and so on, it is, the sad part is that they discovered oil in Murchison Falls National Park, and you see the oil drills in the park itself, drilling for oil, actually pumping out oil inside the park. But the variety of wildlife, especially if you go for a boat cruise on the river, that's what you should do. You know? Very much like at Queen Elizabeth as well, where you go on the Kasinga Channel.
Yes.
Yeah, you go for a boat cruise on the river, and the wildlife viewing is, apart from the bird life, you know, but the elephants, the crocodiles, the absolutely everything is spectacular.
Then lastly, you took an 8-speed automatic Amarok on this trip.
Yep.
How did that perform? Because obviously that doesn't have the low-range transfer case. It just has essentially a crawl gear. Some people were probably hesitant about how that would do.
The most severe challenge that you can put to this vehicle, apart from perhaps sand, if you want to go, and I'm shortly taking it into the Namib to go and see if we can do the real big dunes
that
as well with it as well.
Very interesting.
We're going to do Faces for the Namib at the end of February. But the most severe challenge that you can put to this vehicle is to drive the road from Bunia to Kisangani. That's 700 kilometers. And have a look at the pictures and you can have a good idea of what it's all about. And not once on this stretch, 700 Ks, did I get stuck with my vehicle. Only once had on the long stretch, which was flooded with water, which came up to very close to my snorkel level and so on, I actually had to push a wave in front of the vehicle and so on. That when I exited the other side of this long stretch and so on, that I had to go back a little bit and so on, because my belly plate was actually pushing down the middle maniki and so on, which is caused by all the trucks actually using it. That was the only time when I had to retrieve the vehicle and go forward again. So the 8-speed automatic with the 4Motion With, and that I must hasten to add, is the tires that we have. We had Goodyear Wranglers, but the MTRs, the mud terrains, yes, the Kevlar enforced sidewalls and so on. The most brilliant tire that you can have for a for terrain like this. But apart from that, this vehicle with the 8-speed gearbox and so on was just, it was kind of effortless.
I think you mentioned in one of the articles you wrote for us is it takes a lot of the thinking out of it because it's all-wheel drive all the time and it's got no transfer case. So you don't have to worry about thinking, am I in four-wheel drive? Am I in low range? You just drive and it decides what needs to be done.
You are always in the perfect gear. That's that's the difference. When you, the manual vehicle driven by Francois and he's got his ability as behind a four-wheel, the steering wheel of a four-wheel drive vehicle is good. It's excellent. He got stuck a number of times because he had the manual.
Yes.
He had to make the calculations and so on. And you are not always, sometimes you are not quick enough to make the right gear selection and so on.
Yes.
Whilst this 8-speed automatic and so on does the right selection. You have optimal power transfer to whichever wheel needs it at whichever time and so on. This was an absolute pleasure to drive through the Congo. What we did need, though, and that's also something that one must realize and so on, is we fitted Old Man Emu suspensions to these vehicles. We gave it some body lift.
Yes.
And without that and so on, at first VW asked us to take a cycle suspension. I had the vehicles here with cycles and so on. I said, there's a problem with this. They're too low. The body lift that we have in these vehicles are not sufficient for where we are going. If we remain, cycle is a good suspension. No doubt about that. I think it's brilliant. With Bilstein shock absorbers, if I'm not mistaken. Cycle is good. But not for that application.
Yes.
For that application, you need to lift the vehicle a touch. And so on, and then, and apart from that, and so on, what we got with Old Man Emu. Old Man Emu is brilliant. There's no doubt about it, and so on. And with the extra clearance that we have, and so on, that we had, and so these vehicles were perfect for those conditions.
You also had, I think, an infrared camera that allowed you to see during the night.
Yeah.
Did that end up being quite useful?
Not really. The number of times that we actually drove at night, we try and avoid driving at night.
I can imagine.
At one point, yes, when we arrived at Jinja on the after visiting Obama's grandmother and so on, that took some time. And then we were held up at the border crossing between Kenya and Uganda and so on. So eventually, by the time we got to Jinja and so on, it was after dark. And then I found it quite useful. But most of the time, I think something like that is not for our application. I think there are perhaps other things that are more useful for our vehicles.
But overall, you feel it was kitted out quite well and
very
didn't
well
have any hassles.
Compared to what we had in the past, and so we are scaling down to, I think we are very, very close to the perfect vehicle for a safari in Africa. If you have a look at our vehicles, the pictures and so on, we have absolutely nothing on the roof rack. We have four jerry cans and that's it.
Yes,
a spare tire. And that's it. So we, whilst in the past and so on, we had a lot of rubbish on the top and so on because the vehicles are just overflowing and so on.
I suppose also when you start out, you're very careful and you take anything you might potentially need. But then once you've done this for 7-8 trips, you get used to traveling and you know what you're going to need.
We are roughing it from time to time, so but we still travel in relative comfort. We sleep well at night on a mattress, stretcher with a mattress, proper sleeping bag. We have a good chair to sit in. We have good glasses to drink out of and cups. We have the lot. And we have water purifying systems. We have a generator. We have all the essentials and so on. But there's a lot of other rubbish that we just don't take with anymore. And so on. And yet, every night, you know, the one thing that you won't take away from the Footspooler guys is we eat well at night. We have a good meal. We cook well and so on. And for that, you need certain utensils and so on. So we take that with. So it's not as though we are now roughing it by
just
taking
a Leatherman and that's it.
No. Swiss Army knife and there we go. No, not at all.
And the food? You say you eat well. Where do you get most of your food? Do you actually buy along the way now?
Yeah, we do. And in countries like Kenya and Uganda and so on, you get brilliant stuff. Fresh produce along
like
the way.
Like you mentioned, the ShopRite that you can walk into.
Not only that, little markets along the way and so on. One day on our way to Lake Victoria and so on, I stopped along the way in Kenya and so on. I bought carrots and a variety of vegetables and so on. Brilliant, brilliant, best quality, fresh as can be and so on. So some of the other food that we buy, meat along the way, becomes a problem. Then you buy a chicken and you slaughter it yourself. Buy live chicken.
Yes.
But fish is always easy to
come by.
And so, but we don't really struggle getting food. It became a problem on the river because we spent too much time on the river. And so then we had to revert to, you know, buying fish only.
You're limited in terms of what you can do, your stuff.
Yeah. But then in Kenya, you go to the big shopping centers, you always find a place like a Nakumat or so, which is a big supermarket where you can get absolutely everything. You get to Kampala and so on. There are not only one, but there are two ShopRites. You can get fantastic, brilliant. Some of them are a little bit expensive, but others so cheap. I mean, I bought fillet in Kampala at the ShopRite for something like, I think, 95 rand a kilo. It's about half the price of what I pay in South Africa for it.
Sure.
So the meat that you buy in countries like these, sometimes we deliberately, in Kenya one day, I deliberately went out and bought goat meat because that's what the people eat.
Just wanted to experience it.
And it was fantastic. It was brilliant. Interesting, in all these countries nowadays and so on, you get boerewors, called boerewors. On the packet it says boerewors.
And is it beef or what is it?
Beef, it's boerewors. Like the boerewors you buy here at Groenteloof Slaghuis, you know. It's good. I think they don't always have the recipe correct, you know, there's some spices that we perhaps have, but it's called boerewors. It's good, yeah, it's brilliant.
Lastly, I suppose it's been filmed again for a show, so when can people see it? Where can they catch it?
I'm currently editing, it's hard work editing, trying to get 400 hours down to 13 hours, but we will be on air on the 12th of May. SABC 2, 7:30 in the evenings. So it's the same time slot as 50-50. They finish their current series then, and then we'll take over for the next 13 weeks. It's called Voetspore on the Equator, Voetspore op Ewenaar.
And you mentioned you're busy with the cookbook / journal as well.
We have a separate cookbook that actually will be released early in the new year, early in 2014, which is a separate cookbook, a cookbook only and so on. And then I have my diary, my journal, and so I'm currently working on that. Gideon Swart, our photographer, he's working through his 30,000 photographs.
It's going to take a while.
He has to select 250. Sure. It's a very difficult task and so on, but yeah. So I'm writing the book and so on, that will be released in the course of the year and so on. So it's a TV series, the DVD will be released at the end of the TV series and the books, the different
and
books.
And the previous season is available on DVD now as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely, we currently have seven series available on DVD. Most of them are easiest to get onto the Voetspore website, www.voetspore.co.za. Not all the big, the musicas and so on of the world don't carry them all. But so if people are looking for it, just go to the website and order it 3 days later, you have it in the
And of course,
mailbox.
They can visit the Voetspore store in Woodlands as well.
More than welcome. You know, Francois is there all the time. I'm there most of the time and so on. And what we do at the Voetspore store is obviously we sell stuff and we do fitment of vehicles and so on. But if you once you visited us, you'll realize it's a little bit different. It's a kuierplek. It's a place where you can come and sit down, have a coffee, discuss your next journey or tell us about your previous one or whatever and so on. It's a place that like-minded people come and visit and so on. So we discuss traveling the African continent, because that's what we love to do.
Even when I arrived, I think there was someone there that's picking your brain about heading into Africa.
Sure, doing the hiking the Ruwenzori's, you know, and so and that's what we do all the time. And speak to people about things like this and so on. It's because not only do we give them some information, we get a hell of a lot of information from them.
Absolutely.
The number of people walking through the door and so on, telling me about certain things happening, you know, say, where are you guys going next? And I'll say, perhaps we go through, we want to go to Burkina Faso. And next moment the guy walks to the door and says, but I'm living in Ouagadougou and so on. Come and visit me. Here's my email address. Mm. So we get a lot of information from people actually visiting the store as such. Yeah.
Well, you showed me some of the pictures earlier and they are spectacular. I mean, the roads, you cannot believe it. And we'll be having a photo essay in the February issue of Leisure Wheels, which should be out around middle January. So be sure to check out the magazine and see what the roads in the DRC look like and what a barge on on the river looks like. But thank you so much, Johan, for sitting down with us.
Yep.
And it's been very informative. I'm looking forward to seeing the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure, Gert.
Cheers.
Yeah.